spent the past couple of years in a crazy hot market. Louisville home sales decline as demand outpaces supply. Effective communication is at the core of any situation.
If you master these two ideas, you'll have a chance of being successful at residential real estate marketing.
I think you need to be looking for investment opportunities that move the needle.
The market will never crash if demand exceeds supply.
This is what I've been telling you all along.
This is the Jay Pitts Show.
And we're back, folks. Welcome back to the Jay Pitts Show. I'm your host, Jay Pitts, here with Ryan Harris.
So I was just saying, we should start doing some clips on socials of us pre-show, because I know it's recording when we're just sitting here.
Yeah, and we could just release those. We could probably go back to the radio show days and get some really good conversations.
Yeah.
Because who the heck knows what Jim was recording?
I know what he was doing. Coughing.
Oh, poor Jim. Yeah. I liked old Jim. No, I liked old too. Jim. He just, yeah.
I hope he is not listening to this. Because actually, I like you.
I like you. Jim was great. You know, the radio thing just didn't work out. So here we are back on podcast. Speaking of, you can hear us anywhere you podcast, pretty much like Amazon or the big two, I think, are Apple and Spotify. You can certainly find us there. But
yeah,
certainly appreciate the follow. Put us in your, what do they call it? Your shelf, your podcast shelf. That's the topic. So there's only so much room on the shelf. If we are on the shelf, we appreciate you.
Yeah. How large is your shelf?
I want to say probably 8 or 10.
Dang, but that's a lot.
But I don't listen to that many. Uh-huh. And so it depends on how you look at shelf. So shelf, I think, is what you subscribe to. But it's probably more appropriate to explain it as those that you listen to regularly.
Yeah.
Those that you listen to regularly, I would say 3 to 4. 3 to 4. And then, like, that does not include Rogan, which is, like, I only listen to episodes that I'm interested in the guest.
Yeah.
Because I'm not interested in the MMA stuff. I'm not interested in most of the comedians. Some of the comedians I'm very interested in, but it's a select few. I listened to Andrew Schultz recently. I think he's pretty funny.
Yep.
Pretty smart.
Yep.
You know, very irreverent. So those are kind of smart and irreverent. Like I'm you know, as much as like Bert Kreischer was in town, I like Bert, okay, but he's not really my guy, so to speak. Like that kind of humor is not really to me like somebody like Andrew Schultz is better. Like it's witty, it's quick, it's sharp. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's kind of more. Do you use Spotify or Apple Podcasts?
I use Spotify obviously for Rogan because that's the only place you get it. But everything else is Apple.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I used to use Apple and then it stopped saving my spots in podcasts, oh. So I switched to Spotify.
Well, mine still does.
I don't know. Maybe they fixed
Apple
it.
Apple is it's habitual for me. It's funny. Like, do you do this on your iPhone? Do you do the four things I've got here at the top?
I have it, but I never use that screen.
What are those called? I don't even remember what they're called. But see, podcast is
it's not a widget, right, is it?
It's a widget. That's what it's called. And yeah, so my podcast widget is always up, and it's just I don't think Spotify does that. Maybe they do, but I set this up a long time ago, and it's just probably force of habit.
Apple probably doesn't allow them to.
It's quite possible. Quite possible.
Sipping on some electrolytes right now again. Electrolyte loaded, carb loaded for this weekend.
Is it electrolyte water, alkaline water?
Well, I just fill this up with water, and then I put my electrolyte mix in it.
Is it noon tablets?
No. So I am. So I have the marathon this Saturday.
Yeah.
It is Element.
Element.
So Element, I don't use it all the time. Pretty much only the summer or leading up to a race because it's 1,000 milligrams of sodium.
Wow.
In one little stick.
Wow.
So I'll sip this throughout the day. Kind of electrolyte loaded, carb loaded right now. I don't know, man. It's I guess this is a good lead in to starting our show. It's getting close to Derby. Fun time in Louisville. We just had Thunder.
Yep.
Great Thunder. We have the marathon, Kentucky Derby Marathon this weekend. So I'm running the full. Terrified. It's going to be very warm for a marathon. Yeah. So, like, you really want it, like, I like a marathon temperature to be 40, 45 degrees. It's going to be 65 at the start. 13-mile-an-hour wind at the start, and it's going to be like 75 by the time I finish.
So it was the one time I ran the full marathon, which was 2007, Derby full, which we should probably acknowledge that the second half is not as well supported as the first.
Yeah.
Which if you're certainly a runner like me, which is a novice runner, a large individual, right? The support makes a big difference. The mental state makes a huge difference for anybody, but even more so, I would say, for a novice runner, or I would say maybe somebody trying to do a PR or somebody, you know, really pushing things. But for me, just finishing is pushing. So, mentally, I was completely.
Did the half marathoners go through Iroquois Park with you?
Yes.
So this year it's even worse for the marathoners because the half marathoners turn around after you go through Churchill Downs.
Okay.
So that's mile 8. So you lose all the half marathoners at mile 8, the majority of the 12,000 people running.
There was 11,000 the year I did it and 10,000. It was essentially.
And I'm sure there's nobody in Iroquois Park while you're running through there cheering.
Well, no, they ran through Iroquois with me this year.
Right, but I'm saying like there probably weren't many spectators.
No, there's not any spectators.
So now we lose the half marathoners at mile 8. Mile 11 through 15 is in the Iroquois Park.
Yeah.
Without the half marathoners. So that it's going to be brutal.
So my year, it was very similar weather-wise, which led to, again, as a novice runner running with very experienced people that were chasing PRs, you know, my thought process as an inexperienced person is, I was an athlete, and, you know, when you feel good, you go. And so with it being 60 at race time, I felt great.
Yep.
Like, and I ran the first half in like an hour and 38, and which is way fast. I mean, that's like as fast as I ran the 10 miler.
So fast.
And I was cooking, and we turned like I turned right when all the half marathoners turned left. And realized very quickly that there was no music, there was no spectators, there were limited water stops. I'm sure there were more water stops.
You probably weren't taking gels or anything
either. I did take some gels and some salt packets, but I was not taking them appropriately. Yeah. I ran with two ladies that were like on their 24th and 25th marathons.
Yep.
And they were cooking, and I followed them. And I didn't wear a watch, so I didn't know how fast we were going really. And I wasn't really paying attention to splits because the time was of really no consequence to me. I was hoping to run a 4-hour marathon or a 4:20, which is a 9 pace, I think. I was hoping to run a 9 pace, which is, I think, 4 hour and 20 minutes.
4 hours is like 9:09.
Okay, well, there it was then. So anyway, like all that said, like I ran the first half way too fast. I really struggled going through Cherokee on the back half. Dog Hill like killed me. I was alternating walk and run by the end of it.
Yeah.
And my hips were locking up and, you know, it was just bad news, yeah, but I did finish on my feet and I was very proud of that. It was so to contrast, and this is the last thing I'll say about it. It was like 5 hours total. And the first half was an hour 38.
Yeah.
So it was an absolute slog through the second half.
Yeah, you finished that. A lot of people would give in. But yeah, I'm nervous. Did it last year. My goal is gonna be 3:40.
Yeah.
Changing it to 3:50 with the weather.
Okay.
So we'll see. Cool.
That's awesome.
But more the important thing, I'm raising money for Donate Life.
That's great.
Have like $2,100 raised out of a $3,000 goal.
Nice.
So have until Saturday. I think I did it till Sunday to hit that goal.
Very cool.
Hopefully I can get there. Maybe I won't, but pretty happy about $2,100 raised. Great. So, let's move on. So we're going to jump into the show topics, a lot of real estate topics. I think we should do this because we haven't done this in a while, Jay, a Louisville market update.
Okay.
Because the Louisville market is, I don't know, it's pretty wild right now. Matt Hoagland shared on his Hoagland Report some stats, and we were in a group text talking about it. Just not much inventory out there, but no. Yeah, let's dive into the Louisville market right now.
Sure. So, I mean, more the same, right? Louisville market is like a lot of places around the country. Not a lot of inventory. We're seeing strong demand for appropriately priced properties, right? We are down, you know, 3% on closings year to date from 23, which if you'll remember that unit sales, which is what closings, you know, describe, Unit sales were down roughly 19%, okay, in 23 from 22. So to be down 3 additional percentage points just means, you know, we're kind of pacing, you know, to be roughly 20 to 22% shy of 2022 numbers.
Yep.
I think units actually peaked in 22 here, while in most of the country they peaked in 21. Inventory right now is up 2% from 23, which was not much of an increase year over year, 23 from 22. So while we don't have the pace we had, say, in 22, it's still strong. Still a strong pace. But you're starting to see situations where listings are overpriced and they sit for 30 to 45 days and they get substantial either reductions or discounts from list price at the time of negotiation when they ultimately sell, which they are most of them, simply because sellers are making the critical mistake of chasing the market versus leading the market. I'm hearing some of the most interesting stories in multiple offer situations. I'll give a couple of examples. For those of you that know the Louisville market, Springhurst, good, nice, you know, probably traditionally $400,000 to $600,000 neighborhood in Louisville's East End, has now appreciated up probably closer to the sixes most across the board. Had a client interested in taking a look at a home over there, needed some updating, frankly, and it was listed at $600,000, probably more of a $650,000 type property. Yeah. So the listing agent put the listing up on a Tuesday, withheld showings until Sunday at an open house from 2 to 4. Okay, not my choice, but we've certainly seen it. Client reaches out, says, "Hey, I think this house is underpriced." They live in the neighborhood; they can buy without selling. Very well qualified client. I looked at comps briefly. I said, "You know, I think I agree with you. I'll reach out to the agent, try to get the story." Agent didn't take my call, but did respond to a text. I've received over 80 phone calls. This was on Wednesday. The listing went up on Tuesday. I've received over 80 agent phone calls in the last 24 hours. There was a line to get in the open house on Sunday. Okay. Line was out the door still at 4 o'clock when they were wanting to wrap the open house. Our client, I was coaching baseball. But our client decided to go to the open house, got there right at 2, didn't get in till about 3. Jeez. Did their quick walkthrough. Okay. We had scheduled a 4:30 showing after the open house wrapped. So that I could get back or I could have an agent meet them there to walk through. Turns out I didn't make it because I was still coaching. We made the finals of our tournament. But Luke Andrews, one of our pod leaders, walked them through. And ultimately, there were still people from the open house there at 4:30. And they were shutting the doors at 5 because the seller needed back in the property. Okay? Don't know how many offers. I know it went pending. I don't know for how much. Our client was willing to go $50,000 to $75,000 above list price, which would probably be about $25,000 more than we assessed the value at. Yeah. They chose to not make an offer at all because the house just wasn't perfect for them, and they didn't want to be a part of the frenzy. That's an example, right? When you price, I'm not a fan of event-based pricing. I think it's too risky. But that is an example of what market-based, so we talk about 3 different pricing models: aspirational, which is high and negotiate down; market-based, which is rooted in facts. You put it on the nose, good chance you get 2 interested parties and go slightly above list. Or event-based pricing, which is you price substantially low, incite a crazy bidding war, and hopes that it pushes you above market value. I think that's risky. That's certainly what they employed here. But the one mistake you can't make in pricing right now is aspirational pricing.
Yeah.
Expecting to reduce 10 to 15% over 30 to 90 days of market time, it's just not a recipe for getting the right number. Another example, Saratoga Woods. Great, great neighborhood in J-Town, kind of the Snyder side of J-Town, kind of outside what traditional downtown J-Town would be. Highest sale in the neighborhood ever is $450,000. That was a ranch with a finished basement, sold about a year ago. Just had a two-story unfinished basement, not renovated, come on the market at $450, sold for $550, right? So $100,000 over, highest sale in the history of the neighborhood. It's not a ranch. It doesn't have a finished basement. It's a two-story with an unfinished basement that needs updating.
Wow.
So you're seeing when houses are priced well.
And I would say also that they had to be mostly move-in ready.
Absolutely. Your time is very well spent in preparation for the market as a seller right now.
Yes.
You know, even making small upgrades, like, you know, little things that make the house show well, you know, pristine cleanliness, right? Work off all your punch list, all the, you know, items on your punch list that you know. I was just having a discussion just before we started recording today. Every seller has a mental list of things that they need to fix before they sell. Not everybody gets to all of those items. My advice is wait an extra 2 weeks if that's what is necessary to get to work through those punch list items.
Yeah. No, yeah. I agree. I would say the same thing. It's the move-in ready homes, price 12. It's hard to win those as a buyer now. It's
very hard to win. I tell you who does win is the seller. Seller wins because people are still paying a premium for nice properties that are not shooting the moon on price on the ask, if that makes sense.
And the ones I see sitting, I'm seeing a lot of bad flips out there way overpriced right now. Yeah. I have a buyer looking at a lot of them and just you could immediately tell walking in on it's just not good. Yeah. And they're asking $600,000 for it, especially at the Highlands. I'm seeing a whole bunch of bad flips.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to have a bad flip in the Highlands. Those homes have a ton of character, and they're all 80 to 100 years old, if not more in some places in the Highlands. And they're hard to renovate. It's hard to maintain the character. It's hard to do the work right on a house that's settled and has a 100-year-old foundation.
Yeah.
So anyway, the lessons in all of this is price appropriately now more than ever. And prepare for the market.
Prepare for your interest rates, too, if you're doing a flip. I mean,
agreed.
A lot of these ones I'm seeing are 6-7 months on market. And if it's not cash, they are getting eaten alive by interest.
Yeah.
And
8% interest.
Like they cannot drop the price, but you're going to have to drop the price eventually.
Eventually. Or else you're just going to sit on it. I guess you could rent them, but I doubt that would.
Yeah, but that won't cover your. I doubt that covers your payment.
More than likely not. Negative cash flow is a recipe.
But I guess it's better to lose $500 a month than $3,000 a month.
Something maybe. I mean, well, you don't know. I don't know. $500 a month is a lot. You got to have very limited options to go the rental.
Yeah, but what do you do if you're losing $3,000 a month?
Well, I mean, yeah, you. I mean, that's 1 month vacant is 6 months rented. In that example. So yeah, I mean, I've been in that case. I've had a high day on market, expensive flip with high interest. Not 8%, it was 6%, you know, but yeah, paying $2,500 to $3,000 a month vacant. Right? Ultimately sold it and, you know, all told lost a little bit of money. You know, which is why I've reordered my expectations. I'm not trying to flip high end property anymore. I'm trying to flip small ones.
Yeah. Do you think we're going to get any kind of inventory surge over the next couple months?
No.
Yeah.
I don't. I haven't seen anything yet that I think alleviates the inventory problem. I don't think, you know, Biden's suggestion of incentive for first-time sellers, I really don't. I don't see it making a
difference. As bad as it sounds, you know, it's $10,000. $10,000, like...
Doesn't do a lot.
It's not very much nowadays.
Doesn't do a lot.
When your house... Some people may listen to hear that and be like, oh,
well, entitled, when you're selling your starter home at $350, I mean, $10,000 is almost a minimum price reduction.
Yeah,
when you're at $350 or greater. When I talk to our sellers, we don't do $1,000 price reductions 10 times. We do 5 to 10, 5 absolute minimum. You know, anything over $200, like anything over $200, if it's not a $5,000 price reduction, it is utterly insignificant.
Yeah,
by the way. That buyers negotiate. Buyers negotiate rationally and incrementally. And those increments are 5,000 or more. You know, people don't offer 287. They offer 285. They offer 290. They offer 295.
Yeah. I do think you probably see more agents right now. Like, let's say a buyer's looking up to 350 and you price yours at 360. You think it might, probably is worth 350.
Right.
I don't think you're quite losing those buyers as much anymore because there's no inventory, so agents are having to set the parameters wider. Sure. And maybe they do go see the 360 and hope they can get it $10,000 cheaper.
Maybe. I especially think the houses that are 20 days on market or more, you know, one of our more experienced agents suggested in a team meeting on Monday that we discussed this very issue, that if you're having a hard time, you know, winning the multiple offer situations on the newest to market properties, go look at the ones that maybe didn't price as effectively that have been on the market 25 to 40 days and make $10,000 to $20,000 below asking price offers.
Yeah.
Right. And expect some wiggle room in negotiation because the market is actively teaching the seller that that mistake has been made.
Yeah.
So,
yep. Absolutely. All right. Let's move on. All right, Jay. So, your social media lately, man, it's you've been having some success on whether it's TikTok or Instagram. And I go look at the comments and overall very positive, I think, from
which is
both agents and consumers.
Been a bit of a departure. I've gotten used to some trolls.
Yeah, there still is some, don't get me wrong, but I would say the overwhelming majority is positive, whether they're an agent or a consumer. I even saw one comment that was like, I wish my broker was like this.
Yeah, that was cool.
So, you know, it's going well. What do you think has put you over that edge? What do you think kind of flipped to where the social media content's doing really well now?
Well, it's interesting because there's so much negativity out there. And, you know, we had gotten a substantial boost in attention being paid to what we put out since the NAR settlement. We've talked a lot about it. I think that is reflective of the fact that the majority of our audience is real estate agents, which target rich environment, right? There's 1.5 million realtors nationwide and they utilize social media in their marketing. They consume social media. So I've always felt that it's possible to build a substantial audience of real estate agents. Always felt that for this podcast in its inception, and felt it with respect to our social media and moving towards the short form video kind of platform. Right. So I always thought that, you know, the haters have been progressively more vocal and the NAR settlement kind of supercharged that. We did get, if you go back 6 months ago and look at the amount of comments we were getting, we have substantially more haters now. They're just being drowned out by even more positive voices, which is real estate agents that have appreciated my take or takes on the NAR settlement and the outcomes that I believe will develop as a result. What happened even more, which I think is an interesting case study in social media, because we know negativity does sell on social media, right? And it has been quite some time since I kind of adopted the fight fire with fire, because I go right back at the haters.
Yeah.
Right back at them. And I pull no punches. I try not to curse or be ugly, really, but I'll call somebody a clown on social media, because if they're acting like a clown, then I think it's okay for me to say it. And if they come at me with nothing but the intent to make me look bad, then I think calling them a clown or a troll is not out of bounds. But I won't curse at them. Yeah. Right? I'll make fun of their screen name if it's ridiculous.
Well, let's be honest, 99% don't have a profile picture. And they literally are just somebody on the internet without their name, their picture, just a random account.
That is true. I put myself out there. It's my face and my name, and I can be held accountable to the things I say and that we put out. They can't be because they're anonymous accounts. And I feel like if I'm calling somebody a clown and it's, you know, Joe Blow 89743 with a cartoon character as their profile, like, who am I really insulting, frankly? Yeah. So anyway, I think an interesting study in social media is that my second most viral video ever, second to our parenting advice video, which got about 600,000 views, which was also overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah.
Okay. Is a very positive video. It's a video that we put out last week that has gotten, I was just looking at the numbers. I think it's 85,000 on TikTok, 85,700 views on TikTok. It's at 166,000 views on Instagram.
And that's rare where a video does well on both.
On both, yeah, because they seem to go separate. You know, beyond that, the next one drops down to 47, which was kind of a maybe on the negative side. It was certainly relating to commissions. But go ahead.
Do you think your consistency is what's helped? You know, obviously the Nard thing came along and gave you a really good topic to discuss. But, I mean, been so consistent putting out short-form videos. And eventually, if you're consistent enough, like, it's going to pop off eventually.
I think that's kind of what it's doing now. Having a topical, polarizing topic, right? A polarizing and maybe not topical, but, yeah, a polarizing topic that is in the news right now and gets a lot of attention has certainly helped. What I think is really cool, though, is that it's the positive video of me taking ownership of a mistake and providing a solution.
Yeah, that was a good video.
That went nuts. It does also show a lot of my personality. It's not just the talking head, Jay, which is, I think, what a lot of people have gotten used to, providing advice to real estate agents in our team meetings. Here at RPP, it was a bit more personality. It was positive, and it was taking ownership for a mistake. I've had realtors just come out of the woodworks saying, "This is amazing. I try to do this. Good for you for taking ownership." I've had trolls say, "Oh, you paid $500 when you're making way too much money already." And then I've had people come to my defense. I've had people arguing with the trolls in my comments, like literal full-on 25 comment arguments between two people, one defending me and one, you know, insulting me. And that's never happened before. So that's kind of cool that it was positive. And I think it does prove, we've got a myriad of examples that prove that you can get views, you can get attention by being positive.
Yeah. You know what's really funny about the trolls right now on social media in regards to the NAR settlement? Is, I forget, they like to be called NAR, not NAR, whatever. But it's like they're finally figuring out, they don't know if they should support this settlement or not, because it seems like they're getting educated that this isn't going to fix anything in the housing industry. It's just going to make things worse. Yeah. And we don't really actually support the government. Like, it seems like people that hate realtors hate the government as well.
That's what I've found very interesting with stuff
now,
like,
yeah, now they're, it's like they're trying to figure out, what do we do about this?
Well, there's a few topics like that out there, and I find it very interesting about this one. There are very few polarizing issues out there that don't separate based on political party lines. I don't know if you've noticed that. Like, if you go back to COVID, for example, right? I'll use the example of vaccines and the COVID vaccine, for example. You know, long before the COVID vaccine, the vaccine skeptics tended to skew to the left side of the aisle politically, right? Because they were the party that had distrust for government, right? And it went completely opposite on COVID, but the issue still broke down on party lines. The skeptics tended to be more conservative. The proponents were more liberal. And it's weird that you find an issue. So it's almost like people so conservatives will realize that they agree on an issue with liberals and they don't know how to act.
Yeah.
It's been kind of wild. Politicians are the same way.
I almost think giving money, the way we're giving money to other countries right now for
it's
wars,
another
it kind of seems like, now both sides are like,
wait a minute. We agree?
Why are we doing this?
And we agree? What? Yeah. It doesn't make sense. It's interesting. And this, you know, having like a national news story attached to our industry that is similar to this. I actually can be somewhat of an authority on it, having, you know, opinions that people pay attention to, is weird, because, you know, people agree with me or disagree with me that you would never expect.
Yeah, it's like maybe what's happening is, you know how there's those coaches out there that it's a strategy of theirs to get their team to really bond together as they make the team hate them as a coach, and they bond over that? Maybe our government's
doing the same
unintentionally doing that with all of us, and maybe we'll bond over just hating the government. Well, so much.
Like, for example, Ryan, I've noticed like a lot of people that really are frustrated by real estate compensation are entrepreneur types.
Yeah.
And I find that I identify with entrepreneur types, and many of their ideas, many of our assumptions, many of our values are very similar. Many of our personality traits are quite similar. And then they'll come after, like they'll troll me in my comments talking about how overcompensated real estate agents are, making assumptions that all real estates are the quotient, right? The low level, right? And I just think you and I probably agree on 95% of things.
Yeah.
But you think that I'm terrible because I can be lumped in with the agent that sells 3 homes a year, that doesn't do any marketing, that doesn't do any prospecting, that is not a good negotiator, that this is their second or third career, you know, they're driving Uber, right? They're teaching school. Nothing wrong with either of those things, and they're selling real estate agent, but they're a terrible real estate agent because their focus is elsewhere, and yet they charge the same thing that I do. And I completely understand why people would not want to pay that person what they pay me. But this is all I do,
yeah.
Right? It's kind of wild.
I just said before the show, let's make dues $10,000 a year,
dude. I'm for it. I'm for
it. And a couple people were like, "Well, I'd be out." I don't think they actually would.
I think make them $25,000 a year.
Yeah, I'd pay it.
I'd pay it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'd pay it. I'd gladly pay it. I mean, like, okay. That number one, that's $25,000. I don't have to pay an income tax. Right. And number two, I mean, it's tax deductible business expense. Right. So I'm going to give 40% of that to the government anyway, if it was profit. So you tell me I can get a 40% discount on putting my competition out of business. Done.
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right. We got about
13 minutes left, Jay. So let's move on. So this is a Broke Agent Media article. What's in my bag? Everything agents need to bring to listing appointments. So okay. This is Michael Citron, owner of Parrot Realty. And there's a video of it, but I'll just go through. So he brings a branded presentation folder, marketing materials, iPad, custom notebook, protein bar in case he gets hungry, and a very nice pen. What's in the branded presentation folder is packed with client-focused materials. Marketing materials, so samples that show how Michael will market the owner's property to get it sold, an iPad to review the listing presentation, so comps, such forth. Custom notebook is for taking notes, and then the protein bar and the pen, self-explanatory. So I don't really want you to break that down. I want to know what you bring to a listing presentation. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a lead into that.
Okay. So I walk into a listing presentation with an iPad, a laptop, and a folder. Yeah, I got an ink pen.
So there's some similarities.
I don't need a protein bar. I probably had 4 cups of coffee before I walked in, so I'm jacked. Lots of energy. I listen to like some pretty like crazy rap music.
Taylor Swift.
Definitely not Taylor Swift. Nothing against the Swifties. That's not my jam. My daughter loves it. So I will rock out to some Tay Tay in the car when I'm being a girl dad. But, yeah. So why the folder? I like presenting, or signing at least some documents manually. The seller's disclosure of property condition. And I'm going to say an ideal listing appointment instead of just like every single listing appointment, because they're not all the same. If I have an elderly client that would appreciate, I think that I can make the assumption that they would appreciate manual signatures more and less technology, then I'm going to go full on manual. But I like the seller's disclosure, in my opinion, is much better filled out manually. The listing agreement I like to manually sign because I believe there's more commitment involved in wet signing a piece of paper. Also, I can send everything else electronically later because they're in office, inter-office disclosures for our file that don't go to anyone else. And I like to walk out of a listing presentation with a commitment. And I think the wet signing listing agreement is the commitment I'm looking for. It's the act of hiring me. The comps I like to present on the laptop because I like to click through photos. And show, I mean, I could go tab by tab what I have opened on the laptop because there's a progression. Our listing presentations are in three sections. We do, you know, exposure appeal pricing is our roadmap. Exposure is marketing. So we're going to present marketing first. I'm going to read from them how deep to go into that. If it feels like I'm beating them over the head with stuff they're not interested in, I truncate that a bit. Appeal is a discussion of how they need to present the property. I present exposure as my job and appeal as their job. It's not my job to make sure their house is in good shape. It's my job to educate them on what it takes to present the property to market. That's what I do in the appointment. And then I assign them homework. And then pricing, I say we say for last because it's our job together. It's my decision and my choice on whether I'm willing to take the listing at their price. And it is also my job to advise them on what it will take to sell the home. That involves comp review, which I like to do again on the laptop. I like to have a statistical CMA ran based on the comps I've selected that shows them average prices, days on market for their neighborhood. Typically, I won't get into full on CMA that I do. But that's there. There's a bunch of marketing tabs open, the PVA, the tax research, all the things. I am putting on a presentation of how much preparation I've done.
Yeah.
The iPad is not for presentation. It's to tether because I have a phone and I have an iPad, and not everybody has good Wi-Fi. So I want two devices to tether the laptop to if one of them doesn't work because it's not 100% reliable. Inside the folder, I also have a team, marketing plan book that we have, generated that I can reference a lot of the accolades that the team has. That's part of the exposure presentation. So yeah, that's pretty much it. But nice. I bring a lot of energy too.
Yeah.
Energy is incredibly important.
I think I think a lot of people, we've talked about this on the show when it comes to helping friends buy homes, but when you're selling a home for your friends, that presentation is probably more important than if it's just some random person, because you want your friends to know you're treating this like it is the most important thing in the world to you, like it is your job. Don't go in there all casual. Nope. And you better set expectations because you don't know if it's going to sell fast. And get them prepared for, hey, if this doesn't sell fast, we know it's overpriced or the home's not looking great. So we got to do something about it if it doesn't sell fast.
Yeah. Sometimes the biggest challenge is when the listing's already taken before the presentation because you have the propensity to scale back the formality. And then when the house isn't sold in 3 weeks, they're like, what's Ryan doing? What's he doing?
Yep.
Like, and those are higher stakes because there's a closer personal relationship attached. And so the worst thing you could do is take a listing for a friend or a close relationship and disappoint. Right. So you're leaning in even more so, and understanding that just because you're already hired, essentially, you could just walk in with a piece of paper and say, sign here. I'll call you when the closing happens. Like, you could do that.
Yeah.
But you don't set proper expectations, there's a good chance that there are unmet expectations.
Yeah, and impress them as much as you can because you want those referrals, and that's your best opportunity to get those. So,
absolutely, man.
Cool. So this led to another question I had. What do you take to showing? So when you're showing somebody at home, do you take anything?
Almost nothing.
Yeah,
that's how I am. I will take a flashlight if I know the power's off. I will
tape measure.
That's all in the truck. I've got a set of pliers. I mean, I've got tools and stuff in the truck. I tape measure. I've got a I'll take a friggin' knife in a bad neighborhood. I'm not a gun carrier typically. I've certainly had the occasion that I wished I had been carrying a gun, but my the thought that I would actually kill somebody in a showing like really kind of said, well, maybe that's not for me. I'll just make sure I keep myself out of those situations when possible. So, but I'll take a big knife. I've got a flip out like utility knife that I'll stick in my back pocket if I'm really feeling unsafe. Which is in and of itself, it's not a fancy thing. It's a utility knife that is like a work knife. Yeah. So, there's that. I'll take in a tape measure if I know that they're needing to measure things for renovations or what have you. Usually nothing. I'll usually text people a PDF of the seller's disclosure before they arrive.
Yep.
And the listing. I'll send the listing and the seller's disclosure before they arrive so they have it on their phone. I've got the listing pulled up on my phone, printed out. MLS sheets, I think, are a waste.
Yeah. It definitely is like sending the seller's disclosure before showings is so important because there's probably a 25% chance they're going to decide not to look at the house after they look at the seller's disclosure.
There may be. And like it again is just again shows your level of preparation, right? Oh, this is how Ryan does it. Oh, we bought houses from other people. We're relocating here. We know Ryan. We got referred to Ryan. Oh, this is how he does it. Our last guy didn't or gal didn't do this.
Yeah. You know, the thing about seller's disclosures, though, is I tell a client, you know, seeing a bunch of stuff on a seller's disclosure isn't necessarily a bad thing. I prefer to see that because it means they're actually disclosing
issues.
It's
less likely that they're concealing stuff.
Every house has had issues. So if you see a completely clean seller's disclosure, unless it's like a brand new construction or a perfect flip, like they are hiding something.
Yeah. I agree.
I don't know. It is tough to see a very busy seller's disclosure, though, and want to move forward. But I think it's a good thing.
So. I mean, nothing scares me, and I try to convey my confidence to my clients, and I'm pretty successful at doing it. So I don't know. I'm with you. Novice clients, it may promote another conversation. But like the example I told you about the 80 agent calls a minute ago, the client called me and said, hey, should we really even see this? And I said, well, I don't see a reason not to. Right? Like we don't know for certain that it's going to be bananas. We suspect it might be, but it also may be the perfect home for you. And if you don't go, then you won't know. And so like, that's my approach to a house with a messed up seller's disclosure. Like, hey, maybe it was all handled perfectly. And this person's just overly, you know, just overly transparent.
Yeah. All right. One more thing, man, before we have to hop off here, I saw this stat. It's kind of mind-blowing to me, so I want you to take a guess first if you haven't seen this.
Okay.
So Pulte Group, the nation's third-largest home builder, Q1 of this year, so they announced their capture rate of people buying their homes that also use their financing. What do you think that percentage was of people who bought a Pulte home and used Pulte financing?
I'm going to say 30%.
84%.
What?
So Pulte Group, the nation's third largest builder, just announced a capture rate of 84% in Q1, meaning most home buyers are opting to use their captive lender.
Well, okay.
But they also said 2023 was 78.3%.
See, okay. Well, I would like to see 2022 prior to rates or 21 prior to rates. I bet it was substantially lower. I bet the majority of their incentives have been finance related since rates have increased in 22. So I bet that's the case. I bet they're running 2 to 3% or 2-1 buy downs, and you know they're running substantially discounted financing, and that has to be the reason for this substantially.
Right.
Well, so well,
I mean, it is the reason.
For an in-house mortgage operation with a real estate firm, 25% is a phenomenal capture rate. 25% of your buy-side business is a phenomenal capture rate. That's why I said 30, because I expected it to be higher. And I didn't account in my guess for the fact that they were using steeply discounted financing that you could get nowhere else. So builder mortgage companies, because builders were using financing to move inventory, I could see being higher than industry success. But 84% or whatever.
Bonkers number.
That is a crazy
number. I guess one more thing real quick. Infield prices for Derby this year are $125.
Dude, it's
we gotta get it cheaper. That's crazy.
Did they add bathrooms or do we have shrinkflation going on too?
I don't know. And also I don't think alcohol is included with those in the infield.
No, I don't think so either. But you're allowed to bring food. So, and people say it's still a sport of sneaking alcohol into the infield.
Oh yeah.
So, absolutely. Anyway, is that it?
That's it, man.
All right. That's all the time we got for you this week, folks. We appreciate you tuning in. As always, you can catch us everywhere you podcast. As I said earlier in the show, Spotify or Apple. Follows are appreciated. Put us on your shelf. We'd appreciate that. Also, give us a follow on socials at J Pitts Realtor, at RyanHarris.re, pretty much on every platform. So engage with us there. See clips. See these videos that we keep telling you are getting a lot of views. And if you want to get out the popcorn and read the comments, it's usually pretty fun watching me go back and forth with some of these trolls. So anyway, again, thank you. We'll be back next week. For Ryan Harris, I'm Jay Pitts right here on The Jay Pitts Show. We'll catch you soon.
Peace.